Well, as the people of Ireland say, a great good morning to you. A great good morning to you. What a lovely day it is outside. So, all the more reason to be grateful for the fact that you took time out of that beautiful day to come and be with us here this morning. It is indeed a joy. So, as usual, we have some announcements. Next Saturday is Save a Saturday for January. And we really need your help next week. There's still a lot to get done to prepare the center for winter. Those of you who hear this request this morning and do not manage to come next Saturday, please consider this. You rightfully expect a great deal from this center. Please give some serious thought to how much you contribute to its success. We really do need your service. So next Saturday, the Save a Saturday takes place from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Certainly you do not have to spend the whole time here. You come as you're able. Spend what time you can. If you're here at lunchtime, Mellow Mushroom Pizza is served, and it's a very nice little gathering among the devotees who are here to do seva. So if you can manage to come next Saturday, we really do need your service. As I said a little earlier, we will celebrate Swami Vivekananda's birthday on the last Sunday of this month, January 27th. It'll be our usual schedule for pujas. And we do need help with pujas always. So anyone who can come to be of assistance, please come at 9 a.m. next on the 27th, 9 a.m. Shrine decoration begins at 10 o'clock. The puja will start at 11 o'clock. And there'll be a little talk like usual. And then about Swami Vivekananda. And then the worship. And I'll do the worship this coming for the puja. And then we will, of course, then go into the monastery for our potluck prasad lunch. Any of you who are bringing food to offer to the Lord that day, please do have it here by 11 a.m., no later, because the people who are preparing the plates and the food to come in need time to get it together. So, are there any other announcements that I should have made that I did not make? All right, we'll start with our regular beautiful chant that is a translation by Swami Yogeshananda of this ancient prayer. Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahano Bhunaktu Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavaditamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. May the Divine Being look over us lovingly as a mother and father. May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a mother and father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. Jai, 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 Sri Ramakrishna, jai, ma. Now, normally we would have a song. But it's interesting, jnanis, like atheists, don't have so many songs. So we'll just have to see if we can't mine one out for later on this month when we do Swami Vivekananda's Jnana Yoga. But this morning our topic is Adi Shankaracharya's Jnana Yoga. As most of you know, January is a month for the study of Jnana Yoga, which is also known more properly as Advaita Vedanta. And I say properly, I mean traditionally. As a Jnana Yogi, you practice discrimination reason, detachment, and satyagraha, insistence on truth. Most of us are familiar with satyagraha as the operating principle for Mahatma Gandhi. He insisted on the truth, and the truth, of course, being the fundamental truth of Advaita, aham brahmasmi, but also tattvamasi. And so he insisted on the truth of the divine presence in the oppressors of the Raj, the English who were oppressing India. And so it was not possible to do them harm, but it was possible to resist them in the name of truth. And so the jnani practices this satyagraha. Not in a political sense, of course, or maybe in a political sense, but certainly for their spiritual practice. The goal of a jnani is freedom from limitation, freedom from all limitation. In Sanskrit, mukti. Our teachers say that all miseries in life are caused by seeing inaccurately. An earnest and persistent jnani may break through this misapprehension, maya, and see only the divine presence everywhere, in everything, and everyone. So it's persistence and earnestness. The great jnani, the great Advaita Vedanta teacher, Nisargadatta Maharaj, said, "Everything yields to earnestness." So it's that earnestness and persistence, and we'll discuss the steps as defined by Adi Shankaracharya in a bit. But first, some definitions of terms for those of you who are less familiar with this lineage and this tradition. First, Brahman. Brahman is the source of being beyond time, space, and causation, and therefore beyond thought and speech, said to be nirguna, that is, without the gunas. There are no attributes, no aspects to Brahman. Brahman is the source and the ground of being. So we can't think about or talk about Brahman. We can only gesture. A common metaphor is pointing at the moon. Pointing at the moon is not the moon. We don't know anything about the moon by pointing at it, but we can say moon. So we do that with Brahman. We say Brahman, but we don't have any idea what we're talking about because you can't talk about it or think about it. It is only to be realized. But there is the aspect of creation. This creation that arises from the ground of being. And so we have gods and goddesses, creators, sustainers, and destroyers of the universe by various names, and we're familiar with the names in this tradition, of course. Brahma, Vishnu, Brahma the creator, Vishnu the sustainer and protector, and Shiva the destroyer or dissolver, or one who dissolves one aspect of being so that a new being, a new state of being can arise. When we say destroyer of the universe, we don't mean a cataclysmic destruction, although there is cataclysmic destruction in the universe. We know novas and supernovas and other events, black holes and whatnot. But this destroyer aspect, it's just like a black hole. It's very interesting that Stephen Hawking pointed out that when something goes into the black hole, there's no evidence that the information that was contained, that created that, the name and form, the aspects of name and form that are subtle, remain. And so whatever happens with that black hole, nothing is lost. Its name and form is simply destroyed, its gross name and form. Gods and goddesses are rulers of time, space, and causation, rulers of Maya. They are the power and being of Brahman. This is very much what Sri Ramakrishna taught, that Brahman and Shakti, he called the power of being and the actual being itself, this relative reality we experience, he called that Shakti or Kali. There's no difference between Brahman and Kali, he said, except that Brahman is, he used the image of water still, and Shakti is that same water in waves. And it's interesting that he used the term waves, because that is in fact the reality. This is nothing but vibration. The reality that we experience is nothing but vibration. And this marvelous machine that we inhabit has the capacity for turning that vibration into the reality we experience and share. So this power and being of Brahman made manifest is called Saguna Brahman, Brahman with attributes, Brahman with the influence of the gunas. So there's Brahman, the unthinkable, the unspeakable, the grounded being. Then there's the relative reality ruled by gods and goddesses, that is the power and being of Brahman made manifest. This manifestation, this relative reality we experience, is called Maya. It is made of time, space, and causation. It is this hypnotic dream, of life that ever distracts us from the knowledge of our true original nature, which is Brahman. And one of the great sayings, Mahavakyas of the Upanishads, is Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. Its corollary is Tattvamasi, thou art that, thou art Brahman. So this these great teachings are the ground floor, so to speak, in the Upanishads and in the Vedas. These are the great teachings of Sanatana Dharma, the true name of what the British mischaracterized as Hinduism. Excuse me, my hand is cramping something terrible for some reason. All right. So we're going to talk about how all of this was dealt with by a figure called Adi Shankaracharya. We'll just call him Shankara for short. Who is Shankara? Shankara was a great sage of 8th and 9th century India. His dates are established as 788 to 820 of the Common Era. Though only 32 at his death, he wrote highly revered interpretations of many traditional Hindu scriptures, including the Upanishads and other Vedantic texts, the Brahma Sutras and so on. Shankara also left us books of instruction, such as Vivekachudamani. I usually can say it very nicely. Vivekachudamani, which means in English, the crest jewel of discrimination. Shankara's efforts, including an ability to defeat leaders of other philosophical schools in debate, helped change the spiritual thought current of medieval India. Why is this being able to defeat people in debate so important? These days, it's just something that happens. Someone's defeated in debate and everything goes on as before. Not so in medieval India. If indeed you defeated someone in debate and it was well known that you had defeated them in debate, I mean, it was agreed upon, universally agreed upon, you defeated them in debate, they then had to become your disciple and take your instruction and follow your way. This is why, after methodically defeating leader after leader of philosophical schools in India, Shankaracharya was able to change the thought current of medieval India, an intellectual and spiritual thought current, because those people who had been leading those other philosophical schools had to become his disciples. And most often they became quite enthusiastic disciples. The reason that Adi Shankaracharya was so necessary, we know from the Gita that the Divine Presence says whenever there is a decline in Dharma, in spirituality, whenever vice prevails and Dharma is in the shadows, I will take a form and come among you to restore righteousness. Well, this it's pretty well agreed that Adi Shankaracharya was indeed an incarnation. And the reason that he needed to appear is that during the 9th century in India, time-honored customs of religious life had been fragmented or discarded. During the 9th century, these long-honored traditions had been fragmented or discarded. Materialism, mercenary priestcraft, superstition, and bigotry were prevalent. And if you read the history of India in the 9th century, you'll find that this is very true. All kinds of misinformation was being peddled. That same thing that happened in the Catholic Church, where you have to go through me, you have to pay me money to attain any status, to gain a good place in heaven, to gain a better birth, you had to go through the priests. And materialism, there were these philosophical schools of materialism. They were very much catching on. And so Adi Shankaracharya came to set all this back, to bring this down and restore. And so Shankara and his disciples helped restore non-dual Vedanta Advaita and the Vedic scriptures to their former prominence in Hinduism's perennial philosophy. Sanatana Dharma means perennial philosophy, not the perennial philosophy, nothing exclusivistic about it. As Swami Vivekananda pointed out time and again, that perennial philosophy shows up in every great spiritual tradition, every great religious lineage. So it's just India's special gift to the world that it has been so very carefully and thoughtfully formulated over the millennia. But our topic this morning is not the 9th century in India, and it's not so much Adi Shankaracharya or Shankara specifically as a personality. This morning we will define and discuss two practices that are central to Shankara's teachings. Viveka, discrimination between what he called the unreal and the real, and I'll define unreal and real in a minute, and Vairagya, the release of worldly desires and attachments, which are things of the mind. Shankara says that with sustained attention, and believe me, he means sustained attention, discrimination and release, Viveka and Vairagya, discrimination and release, will certainly lead an aspirant forward in spiritual life, and so at last to realization and life as a jivanmukta, one who is liberated, illumined, while still embodied. And does this take many lifetimes? It can take many lifetimes. Can it happen in one lifetime? Adi Shankaracharya says so. Nisargadatta Maharaj said so. Ramana Maharshi said so. Sri Ramakrishna says so. Vivekananda says so. Particularly in his the great talks that were published as
Inspired.
Thank you, dear. Inspired talks. That was the word I was looking for. Swami Vivekananda's inspired talks. He insists that we can do this here and now. There are many direct path Advaita teachers out there. One of the most prominent is James Schwartz. They say it is just a matter of changing your mental structure. changing the structure of your mind through this process that we'll discuss in a moment. And here's the summary of it. The study of Advaita, these are the steps. They aren't practiced separately. They're not practiced sequentially. They're practiced together. In Sanskrit, the terms are Shravana, Manana, and Nididhyasana. Shravana is hearing or reading these great truths. Manana is the systematic and persistent, and as Nisargadatta Maharaj said, the earnest comparing of those truths and what they might entail for the way you live with the way you actually live now. As Swami Sarvapriyananda said one time, after elucidating the Vedanta Sara over 10 weeks, he did this beautiful class for 10 weeks on the Vedanta Sara. He said, well, now we understand all this. We've gotten all of this in our minds, but we're still behaving, aren't we, the way that we did before this class started. And he said, why is that so? And he said, we have to admit it's because we like it. We like the way we're behaving. Now, this is a very, very important principle for us to get in mind when we are practicing manana. I am living my life the way I'm living my life because I like to. I like it. Even those aspects of it that I complain about but never change, I complain about them, but I never change them. There's some payoff for never changing them, though we complain. So in some way, we're liking it. In another training called the Forum, they call this running a racket. Running a racket. If you complain about it and complain about it and complain about it, but never change it, you're running a racket. So are we running a racket? If we complain, one of the things that we know is that if we are content, if we're practicing santosha, we may just freely admit, I am content with the way my life is. But if you want to change it, then you compare the way you're living with the truths that you're taught, that you've heard, either heard or read. And once those truths become really lodged in you, once they become something that comes to mind when the events of life happen, then you begin to practice nididhyasana, which is insistence on those truths rather than the lesser truths you've been practicing. As Vivekananda says, we do not move from error to truth. He said, if you will, we move from lesser truth to higher truth, which is exactly what you're doing. There's even a technical term for it in the study of Advaita Vedanta. It's called sublation. You replace a lower truth with a higher truth, and you keep insisting on that replacement rather than falling back to your previous way of doing things. So the study sequence is Shravana, hearing the truths, Manana, comparing those truths with the way you're living and seeing which is the more powerful. And then when you are convinced that the truths you've heard or read are more powerful, then you begin to insist on them. This is when you practice as a part of your Nididhyasana, Satyagraha, insistence on the truth. So this is the sequence. And this is very much described in detail in the Viveka Chudamani. Like all of these great compilers, Patanjali, Vyasa, Shankara, he wrote a workbook The Viveka Chudamani is a workbook. You can follow him along step by step in the Viveka Chudamani, and of course, at some point you, and he asserts himself, you need a teacher. Whether that teacher is embodied or not is, that's an iffy business. But it's better to have an embodied one simply because you're more likely to readily believe in that person. You can see them, you can feel them, you can actually experience the power of what they say. Though people have been taught by people who are out of the body, both Sri Aurobindo and Swami Ashokananda. Aurobindo, we know, he lived and taught and became quite influential in the last century. And Ashokananda was the head of the Vedanta Society of Northern California, headquartered in San Francisco. Both of these men were taught by Vivekananda well after Vivekananda had left the body in 1902. So you can have a disembodied teacher because the teacher has the power to appear to you in a convincing way. Now, to get back on track with the study of Advaita Vedanta. Two components of the Jnana Yogi's sustained attention, as were said before, the two primary components of the Jnana Yogi's sustained attention, their persistence, their earnestness, are viveka, discrimination between the relative reality and the highest truth, the absolute. Now, as was said, we cannot do anything but gesture to the absolute. The absolute is infinite, unchanging, undivided. Everything that we experience is finite, changing, and divided, except the truth within us, that which is being pointed to when someone says to you, Tattvamasi. But we don't consciously experience that. It's going on continuously. And so this existence, knowledge, bliss, absolute that is Brahman, it's said that Brahman does not exist. Brahman is existence itself. Brahman does not know. Brahman is knowledge itself. Brahman does not love. Brahman is love or bliss itself. But ipso facto, if you just do the logic, then everything that partakes of existence, everything that is knowledge of any kind, and any bliss or love of any kind, is ipso facto Brahman. So this is where we begin to get this idea, oh, I can insist on this. I experience existence. What I'm experiencing is Brahman. I learn, knowledge manifests, that is Brahman. I feel love, I express love, I experience bliss. This is Brahman. It's not that Brahman is doing it, Brahman is that. Brahman doesn't do, it doesn't. There is no attributes or actions to Brahman. So the absolute is infinite, unchanging, and undivided, but we're experiencing it all the time. Existence, knowledge, bliss, absolute. We experience it within the relative. We experience it as vidya and avidya. Vidya is the knowledge that leads us forward, leads us higher. It's a form of knowledge that leads us higher. And avidya is not only a form of knowledge, but a form of behavior, a way of thinking that leads us higher. And avidya is its opposite, that kind of knowledge, that kind of behavior, that kind of thinking that leads us lower, or at the best, from the avidya point of view, just keeps us on a level plane. We are on a hamster wheel, so to speak, and we keep turning the wheel. We're getting nowhere. We're practicing avidya. Those are the practices of avidya. Time, Space, and Causation, the components of Maya, are finite, constantly changing, and they promote this idea of soham, I am. I am a separate individual. I am a separate entity. I, me, mine. It all comes from this soham. It all comes from this clinging to the idea that this unit, this spacesuit, this experience machine is the me of me. Advaita Vedanta, and as a matter of fact, all of Vedanta says, no, no, no. That is not who you are. You are that which is causing all of this. Identify with the cause, not with the effect. And Vivekananda stresses this over and over and over. Learn to know the cause. Dive deep within. Learn to know the cause. And you will stop identifying with its effects. As I mentioned before, the relative that we experience is under the dominion of Ishvara or Ishwari. Ishvara, the so-called masculine form, Vishnu, Shiva, Ishwari, Kali, Durga. These are the names of the divine masculine, the divine feminine, that are the rulers of Maya and the efficient cause, not the primary cause, but the efficient cause, the cause that is actually making it happen in front of our eyes. These are the rulers of Maya, Ishwara and Ishwari. And from time to time, they take human form as divine incarnations. We're very familiar in this lineage with the names Sitaram and Radhakrishna. Notice that the feminine comes first in these. The feminine, the divine feminine, it's agreed, is the efficient cause. Mother is the creator of the universe. And that's why it's said, this is why, among human beings, it is human women that can produce new life. They are the creators of new life. They are the generators of new life. As it's said in the Chandi, all mythologies and scriptures are your aspects, O Devi, O Goddess. All mythologies and scriptures are your aspects, O Devi, as are all women in the world with their various attributes. So this is why Sri Ramakrishna would bow to all women and call them mother, because he was recognizing the truth. He was practicing the truth. And this is manana, this is nididhyasana, practicing the truth. So every woman, his own wife, all women, he saluted as mother. So these divine incarnations, of course, Sri Ramakrishna came as a divine incarnation. This is our belief. And with him came Sri Sharada Devi. Now, how that name is ultimately going to be formulated in the same way as Sitaram and Radhakrishna is not yet known to us. But in many of the ashrams, many of the centers and societies of the called Vedanta societies, Vedanta centers around the United States, the two pictures are not put in a hierarchical form as they are here. They are seated, they are side by side. And they are, and this is a recognition, as Sri Ramakrishna said, she is me and I am her. And she said the same of him. He is me and I am him. So, these are the divine incarnations, the masters of Maya. And this is why an incarnation like Jesus, you know, there's much is made of Jesus' miracles. To him, they were absolutely nothing. I mean, the master of Maya makes the possible impossible, makes the impossible possible. The lame suddenly springs up, the blind can suddenly see. the dead suddenly rise from the dead, Lazarus rise up. This is nothing to these divine incarnations, because they are the power of the divine presence in human form, and they learn to master that human form to where, by a glance, by a thought, by a gesture, as we just celebrated Kalpataru Day, Sri Ramakrishna said, be the illumined to these people. And so they were. This is the divine incarnation. Advaita Vedanta does not deny the divine incarnation. It simply says the relative reality is not the reality that you wish to focus on. It will betray you. It will betray you ultimately. Because if you focus on it, you will simply die and have to be reborn again, if the focus of your attention is the relative reality rather than the absolute. And Adi Shankaracharya in the Viveka Chudamani calls this a way of committing slow suicide. Now, this may seem a harsh teaching, but if you think about your desire for happiness and freedom, your happiness and freedom, if you analyze it carefully, and it doesn't matter which of the yogas you're following, you must analyze it carefully to find that in this relative reality is only relative happiness and relative freedom. There's no ultimate freedom, no ultimate truth, no ultimate happiness in this. And our seeking for it is only because we don't know our true nature, which wants nothing, therefore no desires, and fears nothing because it's indestructible. Krishna describes it so carefully in chapter 2 of the Gita. Not wetted by water, not dried by wind, not burnt by fire, not cut by sword. Just all of the ways that we think of things being destroyed in the time that he was speaking. Indestructible. As Swami Vivekananda said, this is part of the inspired talks, stand as a rock. You are indestructible. You are the Self, the God of the universe. This is the foundation of Advaita Vedanta. So how do we get loose? How do we get loose from all of this relative reality? The companion to Viveka, this discrimination, ultimately it comes down to what deserves my attention, the relative or the absolute. What is the way? The companion, in Sanskrit, the word is vairagya. Release. It doesn't, renunciation, we think of it as translated as renunciation. Renunciation feels like pushing away. It's not pushing away. It's letting go. If you push it away, it just pushes back. And you can just think about that in your own life. Just, this is the manana part. If I try to push it away, it pushes back. The mind is like that. But if we let it go, if we well and truly let it go, if we release it, then it does not come back. It may remind us of its presence before it goes totally dormant, but it will not push back in the way it does if you try to push it away. So vairagya, release of worldly desires and attachments, and most particularly as a practice in of manana, detachment from rajasic and tamasic activities of the mind. You simply say, this is leading me nowhere. Running after things. As Swami Prabhavananda said, desire is nothing more than a restlessness of the mind. If you calm the mind, less and less desire manifests. The tamasic desires, those that are base desires, those base activities and practices, the darkest forms of our ignorance, We just, in pursuing manana, we say, I know that this absolutely is leading me nowhere. This is not going to do anything but produce more misery. Why? Because of my attachment to it. I want that. I need that. No. No. We release those ideas. First we release the ideas. Then we release the practice. Then we see that there is calmness and freedom in the sattva that overcomes both tamas and rajas. Sattva being that place we arrive at. It's not the goal, but it is a much better place than being in the rajasic and tamasic. We can practice contentment. Now, there are some very specific attributes and practices that are recommended by Shankaracharya. Naveen, would you read this is just a brief description from Adi Shankaracharya, from the Viveka Chudamani, of the characteristics of a spiritual aspirant pursuing Advaita.
A man should be intelligent and learned, with great powers of comprehension, and able to overcome doubts by the exercise of his reason. One who has these qualifications is fitted for knowledge of the Atman. He alone may be considered qualified to seek Brahman, who has discrimination, whose mind is turned away from all enjoyments, who possesses tranquility and the kinder virtues, and who feels a longing for liberation. Longing for liberation is the will to be free from the fetters forged by ignorance, beginning with the ego sense and so on, down to the physical body itself, through the realization of one's true nature. Among all means of liberation, devotion is supreme. To seek earnestly to know one's real nature, this is said to be devotion. The spiritual seeker who is possessed of tranquility, self-control, mental poise, and forbearance devotes himself to the practice of contemplation and meditates upon the Atman within himself as the Atman within all beings. Thus, he completely destroys the sense of separateness which arises from the darkness of ignorance and dwells in joy, identifying himself with Brahman, free from distracting thoughts and selfish occupations. Those who echo borrowed teachings are not free from the world, but those who have attained samadhi by merging the external universe, the sense organs, the mind and the ego in the pure consciousness of the Atman, they alone are free from the world with its bonds and snares. Be devoted to Brahman and you will be able to control your senses. Control your senses and you will gain mastery over your mind. Master your mind, and the sense of ego will be dissolved. In this manner, the yogi achieves an unbroken realization of the joy of Brahman. Therefore, let the seeker strive to give his heart to Brahman.
Thank you. So there's a summary of the qualifications and practices of Advaita Vedanta. It's a very demanding path. It's a very demanding path. Sri Ramakrishna did not recommend it for most, particularly those who have a life in the world. He recommended a combination of the four yogas. And this is, I'll just leave the last word to the Swami who was Swami Yogeshananda. Swami Yogeshananda founded this center. His teacher was Swami Yatishwarananda. Swami Yatishwarananda became a vice president of the Ramakrishna Order. He passed away before he could be elected president. This is from Swami Yatishwarananda, so I'll just leave this as the last word before we begin our conversation. Many people want to practice non-dualistic meditation very often after reading a few books on Vedanta. So many people talk about the absolute, but what do they attain on the practical side? Most of them give up after a short while. They find they are getting nowhere. In the case of a few others, it may take them several months or even years of futile effort to understand that non-dualism is beyond their grasp. People forget that non-dualism is a state of actual experience. It is not what appeals to you intellectually that is important, but what actually you can do. We should not attempt anything simply by reading books. A dualist with real spiritual experience is infinitely greater than a monist without experience. So long as we meditate, and this is so, let's just internalize this, these last couple of sentences. So long as we meditate, so long as there is meditation and the object of meditation, even in the subtlest form, it is dualism. As he said, people forget that non-dualism is a state of actual experience. And what Sri Ramakrishna says is that if you practice karma and bhakti, those two, particularly bhakti, devotional yoga, you will attain the same experience that the Advaitist attains. But it is as Vivekananda said, Advaita is a faster path. Bhakti and karma are slower paths. The combination is a slower path, but much more sure and much more attractive to our natures. So if Advaita appeals to you, by all means, begin to practice manana and You've heard these truths. You can read the Viveka Chudamani. You can read Adi Shankaracharya's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, and see it from the Advaitist point of view. All of these you can do, but unless you begin to do the manana, unless you begin to compare those truths with the way you're actually living and change the way you live, release those things that are holding you back, holding you down, it's just an intellectual exercise. And as an intellectual exercise, as Yatishwarananda pointed out here, and as Swami Prabhavananda also pointed out, it can lead to despair. It can lead to a kind of nihilism and defeatism. Much better, according to our lineage, much better to the teaching from the teachings of Sri Chaitanya onward to Sri Ramakrishna and so on, and for that matter, the teachings of Christ, much better to come from the heart. Let the heart center open. Let reverence overwhelm you. And then begin to just offer your whole life and all that you do to the, rather than release it, you offer it. And so that becomes a different kind of surrender, self-surrender. So I'm not arguing against Advaita. For those who wish to pursue Advaita, well and good, Godspeed and Mazel Tov. But don't think that you can do it just as something you do sitting in your armchair reading a book. Not possible. Viveka, discrimination, and vairagya, the release of that which is holding us down and holding us back, the release of ignorance, is fundamental to all of the four yogas. But they go about it in different ways. So that's the presentation of Adi Shankaracharya's, you know, we could do 10 weeks on it. as Sarva Priyananda did. So with that, this wonderful now, this opportunity for us to speak together about this. Yes?
The whole world is in time and space. So how do you, can you give an example of a thing which is not in time and space?
There is no thing that is not in time and space. There is no object, only the subject is not in time and space. Only Brahman is not in time and space. It pervades time and space as Shakti, as water and waves, as Sri Ramakrishna said. But there is no thing, nothing that we can think of, point to, or talk about is outside time, space, and causation. It is a product of time, space, and causation. And as Einstein said, we cannot solve a problem with the mind that created it. So we have to change our mind. We have to change the nature of our mind in order to realize Brahman. It's much easier, and for most of us, much more fruitful to realize the divine presence in the form of Shakti, the incarnations. And so see the world as their creation and offer everything, because it's, offer everything to them and then accept whatever the world offers us back, whatever experience, whatever thing or experience we have, we accept it as a gift from the divine, which it was in the first place. I mean, which of us here says we created this? None of us can say we created this. And yet, together, we can all say, we created this. We are that. But we just don't know it because of the darkness of our ignorance. Anyone else? Yes, Paul.
What facilitates both vairagya and viveka? Something that you said, the practice of contentment.
So could you repeat the question from the beginning, Vimala? I didn't hear the first
question. You said practice contentment.
Yes.
And once you begin that, everything so much more falls in place.
Yes.
The vairagya, the viveka, the selflessness, the expansion of
yes.
I-ness.
And what is contentment? It is a peace of mind. We achieve contentment from having a peaceful mind. We can't be content as long as we're constantly agitated, as long as rajas is pulling us this way and that way, and as long as tamas is pulling us down into darkness and despair. So it's only through the practice of those practices that yield a peaceful mind that we can truly be content. We can take a stand for contentment before that. We can take a stand for any of these spiritual truths. In spite of the fact that my mind rankles against this and that, I can say, no, I am content. I will be content. I will be content with what the universe offers me. Sometimes it's hard. Now, Paul and then Uma.
Question about the, you know, kind of the Buddha's criticism of asceticism, you know, that there's a middle way, that the beauty of a sunset or the satisfaction of a good meal or a romantic encounter, that all of these things are not to be completely rejected, but just not to become addictions. And I just wondered, does this jhana approach allow for the appreciation of some of the finer things in life like that?
The short answer is no. The longer answer is that as you're practicing manana, you compare the results you achieve from those kinds of things that you just mentioned with what you are yearning toward. If we have a good meal, do we yearn toward having another good meal? Very hard to be truly unattached to sense pleasures. Very hard. So this is why Sri Ramakrishna said, rather than release them, offer them to me. Offer them to me. And then whatever you receive back, whatever you receive, consider it as a gift from the divine, prasad. Then you are surrendering. You're taking the attitude of a servant. What's the glory of being a servant? You don't have to worry about anything. You're housed, you're fed, you're clothed. All you have to do is do your job and offer your services to the master. That's all. This is a much more convenient way to go about life than the dryness of jhana. That's a good question. And Sri Ramakrishna said, you know, go enjoy the world. I have no objection. But when you are sick of it, return to me. I have the cure. When you are sick of it. And this is what's meant by mumukshutva. We're sick of it. And so we yearn for something else. That mumukshutva is the yearning. So when we're truly and well and truly sick of it, and we understand that no matter how I go about it, I'm never going to have any lasting peace, any lasting happiness, any lasting freedom. Lasting means eternal. Lasting means infinite. These others are just coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. As the Buddhists say, they arise and pass away. They arise and pass away. They arise and pass away. Why be attached to them? Yes. Anybody else? Yes.
So you spoke about Brahman, and you also spoke about Nirgun Brahman and Sagun Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you differentiate them, and you know, how would you relate them to the gods and goddesses that
you
talked about?
You are Saguna Brahman.
Okay.
Sitting there, you are Saguna Brahman. You are Brahman with attributes. Mm-hmm. Nirguna Brahman, we can only gesture to by words, by thoughts. We really know nothing. Nothing. Except that if we allow our consciousness to rest on it, if we allow our awareness to rest on it, we can agree. If all these things that are said are true, this must be Brahman. But Nirguna Brahman, if it has no gunas, if there's no gunas associated with it, then there cannot be any thought or speech or any definition whatsoever. It's all pointing toward. But tatvamasi, Saguna Brahman is sitting right there asking the question. And this is all Saguna Brahman, according to the definition. Anybody else? Yes, Uma.
Anyway, I was going to ask, or I was rather thinking, my good mind, what's the difference, if at all, between Vedanta and Advaita Vedanta? But as I listened to the end part of your lecture, it became crystal clear. What I think, and if I understand correctly, what Shankara did was to go into the extreme theoretical aspect of Vedanta, not dualism. What is not dualism? What Ramakrishna and our tradition did with, particularly Vivekananda, was to distill the wisdom into practicable steps.
Yes.
And that's how I think the difference is converged.
Yes.
Because when you make those hard principles of discrimination, vairagya, and all those are very like threatening or very frightening principles for ordinary person. But this Vedanta center, not center, the Vedanta philosophy that we are learning here makes it accessible to most people.
Yes.
How to translate that into action? And step by step, Patanjali, whatever Adi Shankaracharya wrote in Vivek Chudamani, another which is, you know, self-knowledge, Atma Bodha. All these books are wonderful for a scholar, or a purist, I would say. One who strictly believes in theory and very extreme form of not dualism. But this is breaking down into practical steps. And that's why I prefer this.
Yes.
Well,
it's you know, Adi Shankaracharya did what he needed to do. He restored the Dharma. He restored Advaita and the scriptures to their proper place. And it swept through India. It swept through India. Because there was relief, actually. But if you read the Viveka Chudamani and you're sincere with yourself, you will, very few people are going to say, I can do this. Very few people are going to say, I can do this. They need something that starts from where they are. This is why I wanted to read those qualifications. Someone who's already intelligent and learned and very strong of mind, they can grasp these things. They can take them in and they can begin their manana and say, wow, now I understand why I've been so unhappy in my life, why everything's seem to turn out the way I think they're going to turn out. I think I'm going to have happiness. You know, I've done all these things. I've made my intellectual attainments. I've become learned, and I've become successful in life. And all of it is just as if it's like straw. So then they're able to do their manana and say and exercise the, and this you find this in the Vedanta Sara of Vasishta. Strength of mind. And so he says, if you don't have strength of mind, then start with bhakti and raja. didn't mention karma so much, Vasishtha didn't. But bhakti and karma, bhakti and raja. Start with devotion and meditation until you strengthen your mind. What does strengthen your mind mean? Get it calm enough to where the truth of your being begins to emerge, because that's what the strength of our mind really is the truth of our being. It isn't something that we learn to flex it like a muscle and it becomes stronger. But it's not that it wasn't there and somehow it appears. No, no, it was there. We just haven't been using it in that way. We've been using it for lesser purposes.
And as you mentioned, the times were such, because on one side, you mentioned that the ritualistic aspect of Hinduism mm-hmm. was so prominent at that time.
Well,
and secondly, the rise of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the reasons that mm-hmm. he had to be
yes.
very strong
yes.
and defensive.
Yes. Bhagavat.
That's why I wanted to elaborate on the point. He's called Adi Shukracharya, because Adi means the beginning. He was the very, very first Shukracharya. And his main responsibility was to cut the cobweb, mm-hmm. which were stopping the passage of light.
Right.
And he knew that he had a very short time ahead of for him, 32 years. So in that time, he had to establish so many truths. So he pursued like a spiritual scientist, but he gave a condensed truth, which needed to be diluted properly, which the remaining Shankaracharya did. And they are not Adi Shankaracharya, but they are carrying on the message in a more palatable, more practical form. For example, the second thing I see is that Shankaracharya had a tremendous mastery over the Sanskrit language.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, in the shortest possible way, he could give the volumes of knowledge in one or two words. For example, one of the aphorisms is that Asti Bhati Priyam Rupa Nama Chitya Vishankram Ajyatram Jagadruktam Tathodrayam. There are only three basic principles in spirituality. Sat, Chit, and Ananda.
Mm-hmm.
These are the three. So when we come across a thing, you have to classify, like a science.
Mm.
That does not belong to any of these three things. Is it immortal? Is it concerned with your ultimate consciousness? And the third thing, whether it is blissful,
mm-hmm.
Isurangi. If these three things, then this is Brahma Rupa.
Now we have you've given another wonderful definition of discrimination.
Yes.
This is discrimination.
But
is it eternal?
Rupam and Nama is Jagat Rupam. These are mortal. So, for example, if you enjoy the sunset, nothing wrong in it. But no, that sunset comes and goes, and you will be there or not there to see the sunset. When that comes, then all the five principles, you are integrated into your spiritual life.
Right. Exactly. Very good. Yes. Adi Shankaracharya did do an amazing amount in a very short time. And one of the things that he did, that sometimes it's forgotten about, is he also wrote Bhaja Govindam.
Oh, yes.
Chant the name of the Lord. Chant the name of Govinda, Krishna, so that your heart will open and you will begin to understand that there is an awesomeness to the universe. He says your grammar won't do this, won't get it for you. Your logical analysis won't do it for you. Bhaja Govindam. So he offered us the truth with both hands. Anything else? Somebody over there. You always have to holler out when you're over there because I don't see out of my left eye. I'm sorry.
I have three questions, actually.
Yes, please.
First is that when we say that Brahman is still water and Maya is waves of the same water, water with waves.
Mm-hmm.
So effectively, everything is Maya, including the including the gods and goddesses or the Ishwar root that you mentioned.
Yes.
So why is it that in our Hindu philosophy we always have a dualistic representation of God and goddesses together? So Ram with Sita, Radha with Krishna. Though Krishna also in its way, Maya, because it is the action aspect of the Brahman, because it's not still at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it that we always represent Shiv with Shakti, or Shankar with Uma, or Krishna with Radha, or Krishna with Rukmini, or Vishnu with Lakshmi?
Isn't it our experience? Don't we experience both the divine masculine and the divine feminine in the form of all of these forms sitting here? It's impossible for us to think of it. When Mirabai came to Vrindavan and wanted to go into a particular temple, she was forbidden because she was a woman. And she asked to see the head of the temple. And she asked him one simple question: are not all souls female before God? And he took her by the hand and led her into the temple. Yes, it is all. This is all the feminine in that sense. The Maya is the feminine, but it appears to us as the masculine and the feminine. And so there's no way for us to just focus on the one and not the other. It isn't in us to do it. And we have to deal with the fact that this is the unit that we're given with its capacities and capabilities. We can, according to Patanjali, become omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent. We can attain those qualities. But the path to get there, my God. Much, much better to offer, as Sri Ramakrishna said, be a child of the divine, be a servant of the divine. Live as the maidservant lives in the house of her master. She says, my hari, my silverware. She knows perfectly well they're not hers. And her heart is truly in her village. So let our heart be with our home, with the truth of our being. And we just go about our business as a servant or a child.
The second thing that I wanted to ask was that when we practice Buddhist philosophy of being aware or being drishta to whatever is happening around us and not attach ourselves, practice not attaching ourselves to what is happening. So when we are being in that drishta, or when we are drishta, so isn't it similar to the Advaitic philosophy? Because in Advaita we say that being is self. So drishta, when we are situated as drishta, or when we are drishta itself, so which means that we are self at that moment, or we have touched that aspect of self. So isn't there a similarity between that aspect of Buddhism and the Advaitic philosophy?
Sure. Sure, of course.
So there is no difference.
But, well, no difference. You go talk to a Buddhist and they'll tell you there's a difference. But just like they say there's a difference between shunya and the void, as we speak of the void. Swami Prabhupada said, for us as spiritual aspirants, all these things are distinctions without a difference. Don't worry too much about it. Focus on your practice. And as Sri Ramakrishna said, when you come into the neighborhood of God, all of these controversies, all these paradoxes are resolved. And you said there was a third thing.
Yeah, third thing is that if someone is by nature drawn towards being in that being, but at the same time also want to practice the dvaitic aspect, the bhakti aspect of it. So what is the way? How to balance the dvaitic aspect while being in that being and while externally worshipping it? Also enjoying the breath aspect, because normally what I have experienced with myself, that I'm not able to balance these two.
Yes. Well, my suggestion is that for your Shravana, you read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Ramakrishna explains it in some detail. And the conclusion that he reaches is, when you reach the roof, you understand that what the roof is made of, lime, brick, and brick dust, that is exactly the same thing that all of the steps were made of. So again, it's this knowledge of the divine, the full knowledge of the divine, that allows us to resolve all of these controversies. And of course, as you work your way through the gospel, you will find that over and over and over again, Sri Ramakrishna says, for those of us who live in the world, let us practice bhakti, let us practice devotion. And if we practice devotion and we practice it in the spirit of karma, as taught by Krishna in chapter 3, if we practice it in that spirit of offering everything, then what happens is we're relieved of these controversies. We're relieved of these paradoxes. We don't have to worry about, am I being true to all of the Advaita principles? No, you just do. You just live your life as in this way of devotion to the divine and offering everything to the divine. Trying to remind myself I'm not attached to anything. Sri Ramakrishna calls it mental renunciation. And he says, nothing can be achieved without renunciation, but those who live in the world must practice mental renunciation. Otherwise, you have to take to a monastery or a convent. Yes?
How do I know when it's true devotion? You said to become a servant of God, or it's an easy way out because we don't like confrontation.
It's an easy way out. Well, that's... I hope I didn't say that too simple-mindedly. But
sometimes we wonder if we really are devoted or we're being trying to be a pleaser.
How do your actions register? How do they register with others? If others are giving you the feedback that you are... You know, this gets into that nettlesome idea of codependence, this thing of being a pleaser. Hmm? We must be sincere with ourselves. We must be sincere. So how do we gain the knowledge of our sincerity? Through spiritual practice, through practice of contemplation, concentration and meditation. Slowly and slowly we get clear about what's true about ourselves and what we're doing, as you say, not quite authentically. Then we must have the courage to stop doing that which is not authentic. And what people find is that actually, the people that they're interacting with are relieved because they sense that inauthenticity. And so there may be some burbles, some difficulties, but over time, and I'm speaking from having been a married man for 47 years to the same woman. So we have to learn what's compromise and what's codependence. And it requires being sincere and honest with ourselves. And that's a very, very good question indeed. But it's only through the self-knowledge that comes through practice of contemplation, concentration and meditation, that we come to know the truth of ourselves. And we know, we begin to sense the causes of our behavior. Which means that we have to be persistent. As Nisargadatta Maharaj said, everything yields to earnestness. Earnest and persistent spiritual practice. Swami Prabhavananda's four instructions for meditation. First instruction, the chosen ideal is you yourself. Learn to feel that living presence. Learning to feel that living presence begins to encourage you and transform you all by itself. Second instruction, patience. Patience. We just must be patient with ourselves, with others in our lives, with the world, and with our practice. Third instruction, persistence. Day in, day out, though I don't want to this morning when I get up, I just don't feel like it, you do it anyway. We mustn't let tamas drag us down. So, or rajas. Oh, I have to be busy doing that, so I can't take time with my spiritual practice. Fourth instruction, expectation. At any moment, I may break through and have the fullest of realization. As Swami Prabhupada said, those of you who are patient and persistent are only a hair's breadth away. So we just need to keep our minds on that, that we're just a hair's breadth away. If we're patient and persistent, and these things resolve themselves. But to be honest with ourselves about our motivations is one of the most difficult things that human beings do. It's why people go to therapy, because they know that their minds are clouded by what they've learned and not learned as they were growing up.
Expectation.
His word was expectation. Expect that the miracle will happen at any moment. You just don't know when. And he was very emphatic about that. You do not know when. You do not know how close you are. It's nearer than the nearmost and dearer than the dearest. And so just how close it is, just how thin the veil is between us and the truth, we don't know. It may seem very thin, but all we have to do is, it may seem very thick, but all we have to do is wet our finger and poke through it like crepe paper. Believe it, yes. Expect it. Not just believe it, but expect it. It's a yes in the back there.
I thought we have to be desireless in our pursuit of divinity and not expect something in return.
No. Spiritual desires are not like other desires. Ultimately, you come to where you release both the good and the bad. But that's very far down the path. To have spiritual aspirations, spiritual desires, spiritual aspirations, spiritual expectations, perfectly wonderful, perfectly appropriate.
It won't lead to frustration? Expectation?
Dear heart, if you persist, you will succeed. That is the promise of every one of the great teachers. Expectation only leads to disappointment in the world. Not in the spirit. This I can testify to. This I have seen not only in my own life, but in the lives of many others. Expect that something wonderful will happen. Spiritually. Yes, dear.
I think one of the Swamis who had come to visit, and I don't remember which one, He gave a good difference between spiritual desire and worldly desire, mm-hmm. and why spiritual desire is never a bad thing, mm-hmm. because in worldly desire, if you desire something, you get something, somebody else is deprived of it. Mm-hmm. Whereas in spiritual desire, you're not competing. Everybody has the same opportunities, so to speak. So you're
Perfect.
Not competing.
Perfect.
So there's no limitations to how much you can do spiritual desire.
Ah, beautiful. I'm glad you remembered that and brought it up. Was that heard? Spiritual desires are, if the fulfillment of your spiritual desires does not deprive anyone else. There's a certain aspect in worldly desire, fulfilling worldly desire, of depriving someone else. That balance. But that doesn't exist in the world of spirit. I wonder if that was Yogatmananda or Atmarupananda. I don't.
I think it was a Swami from Rhode Island.
Oh, Yogatmananda. That's what I thought, yeah.
One of the examples which was normally given in this aspect is the gopis desiring Krishna.
Uh-huh.
Everyone had one, though there was just one Krishna.
Yes, mm-hmm. Everyone had their own Krishna. And we, you know, this is the thing for us to understand. Each of us, as we sit here, if we take seriously, tattvamasi, aham brahmasmi, we are that. And we are unique. We are somehow this unique Atman, this unique wonderfulness, this splendid thing that is somehow hemmed in by our own ignorance and our own, what we've learned is true that is not true. And so it wants to burst forth. As Marcus Aurelius, the great Roman mystic poet, said, it loves to happen. And we don't let it happen. We hem ourselves in. Spiritual practice frees you. It really does. And I'm really glad you brought that up. That is perfect. That is perfect. Your fulfillment does not deprive anyone else. As a matter of fact, your fulfillment, by the fact that your light shines more brightly into the world, actually is a great benefit to others. Yes, please.
I have to add the analogy. I don't know where I heard it, whether it was Ramakrishna or it was the Gita. I don't know where I heard this, but like the desire for spirituality is like when you have a thorn in your flesh, you take it out with another thorn,
mm-hmm.
pull it out, and then throw both the thorns away.
Yes.
So that last desire is like taking it out and then throwing both the desires away, and
yes.
therefore getting, mm-hmm. The ultimate.
Yes, that is that resort to that analogy is a very good one. We take the thorn of ignorance out by the thorn of knowledge, and then because both are within vidya, both are within maya, we throw both away, and we're free from both knowledge and ignorance, lower knowledge. In the meantime, it's good to have that thorn of knowledge working away at getting the thorn of ignorance out of our foot. Sham, did you have something? No? Okay. Yes, Bhagavat.
See, one conflict comes because Sanskrit is a very rich, sophisticated language, which unfortunately English is not. Therefore, for example, desire translated in Sanskrit is vasana, which is different, which is a crude desire. But Sanskrit has about 20 names for different kind of wishes, desire, akanksha, mahatvakanksha, ishwarecha, mayecha. Each one gives you a different spectrum of the same thing which we call desire. Similarly, contentment is both dosha, contentment is dosha, means you are quickly satisfied, easy satiety. That is called dosha. But when it is balanced, it becomes santosha. So what you said, that one should be contented, but contented in the sense of santoshi, not toshi. And one more thing I wanted to bring up in conjunction with what you brought, is the historical aspect of Shankaracharya. Why man-woman couplets? That when Shankaracharya had to combat Mandan Mishra, who was a great scholar at that time, and again we call it debate, but really in Sanskrit it is charcha vicharna, discussion and thinking. That's debate. But anyway, he had about 15 to 20 days of ceaseless discussion, at the end of which Mandan Mishra says, okay, I give up, you are the winner. So at that point, Mandan Mishra's wife comes in. She says, you have won only one half of our couple. Mm-hmm. The other half, I am there.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, he had continued discussion with his wife. At the end of the day, she says, me too. And that's how she submitted, and Shankaracharya became an established scholar.
Didn't Shankaracharya rebirth in some another form to get all the knowledge that she said he didn't have?
This is the story, yes. Yeah, he assumed the body of a king who was at the point of death,
right.
And gained the knowledge that he needed to go back and defeat the wife. This is part of the story, and the truth of the matter is that Shankaracharya prevailed. However he did it, he prevailed. And he prevailed over all of these other schools of thought and restored Vedanta and the Sanatana Dharma to its proper place in Indian spiritual and cultural and intellectual thought. And so he is still revered as a result. And it's important to remember that the name Shankara, the name that it's a name of Shiva, he did only good to the world. That's what that name means, one who does only good to the world. And so that's a hard ladder, to do only good. Yes, anything else?
Actually, I may add one thing. He was so successful in debating discussion that practically Buddhism had to move out of India. Since he came, he re-established Sanatana Dharma for all its base points. And so Buddhism, if you notice, spread outside India more than in India.
Well, Vivekananda explains that. I won't go into it now, but he explains in some detail why he thinks Buddhism failed to last in India. But it's just exactly what a great Zen scholar said to Swami Prabhavananda. His name is escaping me now. He was a very famous scholar of that time in the 50s. Zen scholar. In any case, he said to Swami Prabhavananda, I'm having a problem with Zen because it has no heart. And Prabhavananda nodded and said, yes, and I'm having a problem with Vedanta because it has no discipline. So, is that it?
In my comparison of English Sanskrit, I should add parenthetically, in one area, English supersedes Sanskrit, that the members of the family in English are called relative, which is so true. They are not absolute. They are relative.
Well, sometime you and I are going to have to sit down and talk about this, the English of Shakespeare, which is rich indeed. All right. Is there anything else? All right.
This is truly a satsang, you know. So the satsang that they talk about, this is truly satsang that we talk and we discuss.
Yes. Oh,
we
yes.
We all bring our little words into this. And
it is, it is.
And the thoughts. It's
yes.
Truly wonderful.
It is, and it is
like
a joy.
He said vichara. What was the name for it? Vichara?
It is charcha vichara.
Charcha vichara.
Yeah.
Good. Yes, well, and it's so good that we all participate
dosha
this way.
And santosha.
I know, there's a new one.
Yes.
All right, we'll close with our regular chant, which again is a translation by our beloved Swami Yogeshananda. It's an ancient prayer for peace. Let there be peace in outer space. Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters. Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees. May the gods be peaceful. May the whole universe be pervaded by peace. Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Let this infinite universal peace.
Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace. Peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere.